Want a chance to win 250 pounds in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be 250 pounds better off.
Hello, and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. The 1990s were an important decade. They saw the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, falling trade barriers, and the rise of what came to be known as the liberal international order. But the 1990s also sowed the seeds of the rise of populism and anti-globalism in Western democracies that are now complicating global politics and governance. A new book, Rethinking the 1990s, Liberal World Order Building in the Aftermath of the Cold War, looks back at how important the 1990s were and the opportunities that were missed at that time by politicians. In April 2026, I sat down for a conversation with the book's editors, Professor G. John Eikenberry and Professor Peter Trubowitz. G. John Eikenberry is the Albert G. Milbank Professor of Politics and International Affairs at Princeton University in the Department of Politics and the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. Peter Trubowitz is Professor of International Relations and Director of the Phelan U.S. Center at LSE, an Associate Fellow at Chatham House, Royal Institute of International Affairs. We spoke about their new book. Our discussion covered what makes the 1990s such an important decade for the world today, how the U.S.'s liberal bet on China failed, and how U.S. and Western attempts to expand liberal internationalism were met with resentment abroad and at home. We also talked about the lessons the U.S. can take from the decisions made in the 1990s that are still affecting global politics. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I hope you do too. Well, thank you so much for joining us in the Ballpark today. Just to start things off, can you set the stage of the 1990s for our audience? Why a book about the 1990s, and why now? What makes that decade so important?
Well, Chris, I mean, I think first, John and I were looking for an opportunity to collaborate and eventually landed on the idea of convening a group of leading scholars in London and then subsequently in Princeton to reflect on the 1990s. And we decided that was really the way to go. In my case, my interest in the 1990s is that I was coming off of a book that I wrote with Brian Bragoon, who's at the University of Amsterdam, about the rise of anti-globalism in Western democracies that identifies empirically the 1990s as the decisive decade. In the shadows of the triumphalism over winning the Cold War, opposition on the far left and especially on the far right began stirring, and those grievances eventually morphed into the kind of populist wave that found expression in Brexit and Trump's presidency, his first presidency, and then the spread of anti-globalism more generally that we see across the West today. And so for my part, I was really keen to explore this decade by bringing other scholars into the room or have them at the table who wrote during that period, like both John and I did, and would have an opportunity to kind of reflect looking back on how consequential the decade was, where they would come down on that, the extent to which they thought there were missed opportunities, that the current kind of unsettled moment, the extent to which it could be traced back to that period. And John was the perfect person to work with on this.
Yes, I really enjoyed this collaboration with Peter and with our cast of characters who wrote chapters for this book. For me, the idea for the project was traced to my own work on post-war settlements. Indeed, it was at the end of the Cold War, as an assistant professor looking out at the world, looking at the end of the Cold War, I saw it as a post-war settlement and put it in the company of 1945, 1919, 1815, 1713, 1648. So what was it about this period after a major shift in the global system, a collapse of bipolarity, the shifting balance of power, the ideas that were driving the new period that was opening up, And the academic question that has always been in the background, and I think it's in this book, Between the Lines, is how do you think about switching points and turning points in history? Are there moments, and we think there are, when things become unsettled because a war is over and new opportunities exist, a plasticity to history opens up, not forever, but for a moment, and what can be done at those moments? And then with that question of what things were put in train, kind of path-dependent decisions, were they decisions that we should applaud or regret? And as we will find out and discuss here, a combination of all those things. Very important progressive steps and indeed missed opportunities, I think, in other ways. So that would be how I came to approach this book project.
So as John suggested, there's a number of missed opportunities that if the U.S. and Western governments had chosen a different path, we might have ended up with a different outcome today. One, as Amrita Nalakar argues in her chapter, was the failure to reform the U.N. and the post-war international institutions, the Bretton Woods institutions, to more closely reflect the actual international distribution of power that she argues is led to partly one of the things that led to the resentment, the international resentment against the liberal order. Another, as Jennifer Welch argues in her chapter, was the failure of U.S. leaders in particular to more fully embrace human rights. So she argues that if they had, it might have turned liberal hopes to hold governments accountable, that is, foreign governments accountable, into concrete achievements. I think in the same vein, and this is maybe just a summary point about going back to John mentioned China and Russia, what you see in the volume and the chapters by Mick Cox, and I mentioned before, Miles Kaler, is that there are questions about whether if the United States had been more accommodating of Russia's insistence on security and less willing to turn a blind eye to Chinese mercantilism, we might have seen a more cooperative Russia and a less nationalistic China. So I think one of the nice things that in this volume, we basically tasked every author to consider counterfactuals and to consider other pathways and the choices that were made and could it have been different. And literally every author in the volume does that in one way or another on the topic that they're considering. And I think it's one of the things that makes the volume very rich and interesting.
Thank you. So many scholars and commentators have often talked about the 1990s as the end of history, to borrow Francis Fukuyama's phrase. How does your interpretation compare to that idea? And how does it question the validity of that phrase?
Well, that is the most famous essay that came out of this 1990s period. But we should remember that there was a wide debate. There were lots of different anticipations of things to come. There were actually more emphatic statements by realist scholars about the end of the Cold War leading to a collapse of the West, of NATO, of the alliance system, of the trilateral world, U.S., Western Europe, and East Asia. There were civilizational clashes that were going to come our way. Kenneth Waltz, the leading IR scholar of that period, was in fact saying NATO's days and months may not be over, but in the years ahead, it will unravel, given the absence of an external threat. The Soviet Union has disappeared. But Fukuyama, I think, did say something very important in that what he saw and what we all saw and what we should remember now when we're in this time of troubles, when the liberal order that we thought was going to emerge and become dominant in that period is now unraveling and in great crisis, that it was a moment when all the other 20th century world order projects by rival great powers, all of them illiberal, think of World War II and fascism and Imperial Japan and then the Soviet Union. These were the great rivals, fascism, communism, autocracy, imperial great power, order building projects. They all came crumbling down and were escorted to the trash bin of history. And this was the only one standing. And that is true. But what do you make of that? And that's what Fukuyama made of it, was that it tells us something about the directionality of history. And what I think I would argue, and I think comes out of the book, is that liberalism has within it the seeds of its own disorder and problems, that the seeds were planted there in the moment of triumph. And more generally, what we would see looking back is that, this is how I would put it, that the deck of cards of history is not stacked in favor of liberal democracy, but liberal democracies do hold some aces. And those aces are capacity to work together, to frame the project of order in a more uplifting, moral, elevated way that at least has the possibility of gaining widespread legitimacy. So those sorts of things are not wrong, but the kind of intellectual overreach that some people might assign to the end of history thesis probably is not where we would leave the discussion.
Well, I think the volume shows beyond a shadow of a doubt. It underscores what John just said, is that the intellectual debate in the 1990s was much more wide-ranging, fluid, open than just Fukuyama's vision of liberal modernity's triumph, the kind of view that it was that all the way down. So you had realists and liberals and nationalists and globalists and scholars and commentators disagreeing really over the shape of things to come. So many predicted, in fact, heightened competition within the West for economic advantage, that friends would become foes. In fact, there were books and articles written with that title. Others argued that the post-Cold War world would be one of increased military and security competition, that Japan and Germany would become formidable great powers, that NATO would weaken and break up, that alliance commitments would become more fluid and shifting. The end of bipolarity, they predicted, would usher in a return to traditional multipolar politics. And in many respects, none of these things happened. What happened is that the United States and the West, I would say more generally, doubled down on liberal internationalism to the point at which it overreached, or it overstepped, in my view of this, what the domestic foundations in one liberal democracy after another would support. And so that you end up with this kind of gap. So this is like John's point about it kind of, or one version of it, it kind of sows its own destruction if taken to an extreme. And so to the extent that these ideas like hyperglobalization, institutionalized cooperation were consistent or are consistent with Fukuyama's kind of vision of liberal modernity, then you could say that in fact it took hold, and down the road, but way down the road, there was a backlash to it.
So in the book, you write about missed opportunities for Western governments in the 1990s. Can you talk about what these were? And what consequences did this have for the 21st century?
Yes. Well, I would like to emphasize that the book shows that there were successes that were kind of double-edged in their character, as Peter's just suggested. What was most remarkable about the 1990s was how active and activist and ambitious liberals and liberal internationalists were, and how eager countries and peoples in Europe and Asia and Latin America wanted to join this expanding capitalist democratic order, which generated trade and exchange and human betterment. You might even argue the year 2000, the end of the century, the end of the millennium, might be the year that you could argue was the greatest year that humans have lived on Earth. There would be no other time or place that you would want to be in history, not even the second century of the Roman Empire, in terms of the experience of physical security, of benefits of wealth and growth, and a glimmering of social justice. So this is a time that wherever you were, a kind of John Rawlsian kind of, you don't quite know where you're going to end up, but what year would you like to plop down somewhere on Earth? It might be that period. That being said, there was something remarkable that the United States and its liberal democratic partners saw themselves engaged in, expanding the institutions, building out, reinforcing security cooperation. NATO was expanded. U.S.-Japan alliance was deepened. But along the way, the missed opportunities, I think, are of a couple different sorts. One is looking back, and some of our authors make this point, that there was not enough sharing of the authority. There were other countries, think of Turkey, think of middle powers, that were interested in getting closer to the liberal order, but were not given full rights and privileges of leadership. So I think that's part of it. And then secondly, the failure of understanding that a liberal order is not simply an open order that has boundaries that extend to the horizon, that it has boundaries that have to be maintained. That is to say, to be inside of it requires responsibilities and buying into commitments and obligations. And in that sense, the order in its moment of feeling like it's something that everybody wants to be part of, there are no other ordering projects on the horizon. And it kind of failed to attend to its foundation, as Peter said, the kind of domestic compromises and embedded liberal institutions that would provide, and in the past did provide, buy-in by industrial society populations who are happy the world is moving in the direction it is, but it's having the effect of eroding some of their domestic social supports for living in this brave new world of liberal order.
Thank you. So could you explain the liberal bet that the West, particularly the US, took with China, why it failed, and what other consequences this has had?
So this is a really big topic, and the US story is very nicely captured in the volume by Miles Kaler. And where he lands is he says it's about domestic dynamics that American presidents got wrong or at least underestimated. They weren't as naive as many today make them out to be, but they also didn't fully appreciate how incorporating China into the world economy would create dislocations inside the United States in terms of lost jobs, depressed wages, and the hollowing out of local communities. China was basically the poster child for globalization. And the resulting China shock, as it's called, to the American economy, fueled political grievances and resentment towards China, to be sure. But more fundamentally, I think, and this maybe goes somewhat beyond Miles's argument in the book, towards American elites who presided over this arrangement, this opening up, Democrats as well as Republicans. And this is what Donald Trump ultimately capitalized on. I mean, Bernie Sanders was making a very similar argument back in 2016 in his run for the Democratic nomination, but Trump really harnessed it. The interesting thing to me is to think about this not only on the US side, but the China side, the Chinese side as well. Because it seems to me that in some ways, the liberal bet about how globalization, increased trade, and investment in China would change China, in fact, was right. What they got wrong is it changed it in ways that they did not anticipate. They thought it would make China more liberal, let's say, or if not liberal per se, I don't think people really went that far, but that they would abide by rules, international rules, that they would open up, that they would move away from mercantilism, and that there would be a kind of, as more and more people were lifted out of poverty there and into the middle class, that there would be greater and greater buy-in to a kind of open, if not liberal, just an open rules-based order where they could assume that their kids' lives would be better than their lives. The problem with that theory is there was a backlash to globalization in China. But unlike the US, where it was from the bottom up, in China, it was from the top down. It's the party that backlashed. It's the party that felt like it was losing altitude and political ground to the private sector that was nourished during this period. And so you have this kind of where globalization triggers a response in both countries, but pushing both countries in a more nationalist direction, I would say, but for very different reasons.
That is the good summary of what the book speaks to on the failure of the liberal bet on China. I think what that view entails is the rejection of the stronger view that's out there, not in the book, but by some grand strategists who argue that the U.S. should have engaged in a kind of preemptive containment of China before it started its multi-decade double-digit growth. Miles Kaler takes that argument on and shows that that's not necessarily the most effective way of dealing with something that is world historical, the rise of China. taking advantage of the capitalist world economy, but not fully participating in it on terms that the others seek to establish. But the kind of conditionality that joining the WTO, but on other terms that would have made access to markets more contingent on domestic reforms and so forth. So I think that's important. It's also important in defense of liberals looking at China in the 1990s. It's important to remember that it wasn't simply a one bet on one thing, that we're going to invite them into the WTO and everything will happen in a positive direction. There was simultaneously efforts to build out the infrastructure of East Asia, redoubling the U.S.-Japan alliance, putting more efforts into regional multilateralism, both on economic and security terms, to create more of a bulwark that could be a framework not to contain China as such, but to provide counterweights for sure. And then secondly, to provide institutions that China might want to use to commit itself to signal its restraint. Because the great problem that China has in this period and continues to this day is how does it prevent countries from the old diplomatic problem of self-encirclement, that you just by being more big and powerful, you are provoking other countries to balance against you. So how you deal with that is you tie yourself to institutions and you make yourself more of a collaborative actor. And that was part of the Western design for dealing with China. So it was a more multifaceted framework. So there were a couple different bets. But of course, the trade bet, as Peter said, didn't turn out so well.
So in the 1990s and beyond, the U.S. and the West more generally sought to expand the liberal order. But this was met with resentment abroad and an erosion of support for liberal internationalism at home. Why did this happen?
I'm going to focus on the at-home part, and maybe John will say something about the resentment abroad, when and how it manifested. On the domestic front, I think the short answer is that the United States and Western governments more generally overreached. So they expanded the opportunities the liberal order in fact offered in terms of jobs and profits and prosperity horizontally to more and more countries. But at the same time, they were effectively shrinking the economic security guarantees and protections for their own citizens. And that's because while they exposed their own populations to more economic risk in the form of competition from abroad, like cheap Chinese goods coming into the United States, for example, the domestic social guarantees that were once the pillars of the liberal order back in the post-war era and for decades, those did not keep pace. And in fact, in many cases, the US, UK, but there are many cases in Europe as well, they were rolled back, those social protections. The main thing was that a gap emerged between the level of risk, economic risk, in my view, that populations, Western voters basically, were being exposed to, and that the security guarantee embodied in the welfare state and so forth did not keep pace. And so at some point, that gap got too wide and it began to generate, as I've said earlier, you can see the tracings of this, the origins of this back in the 1990s. It led to grievances, to resentments, to anger, and then the backlash.
Yeah, I think that internationally, the grievances had partly to do with what we were talking about earlier, that this is a moment of openness, expansion, institutions were expanded. NAFTA, APEC, NATO expansion, the WTO was launched. So this is a moment when the architecture of the international order was opening, showing that there was some evidence for the proposition that the liberal order is easy to join and hard to overturn, an argument I've made some years ago. But at the same time, various countries were finding that they were not getting equal access to markets. There were still protectionist barriers, that in some ways the problem wasn't with liberal international order as such, but that it wasn't fully manifesting itself. The opportunities that it would provide in its principles and institutions were not being as widely shared on equal terms. And then there were the ancillary problems. I think the problems having to do with American management of it. So the kind of, if you make a distinction between American hegemony and liberal international order, we conflate them often. A lot of the global South is worried about American hegemony, but actually wants more, not less, liberal international order. The Iraq War was, in some sense, the first of these great kind of blows against American legitimate authority as a hegemon, a liberal hegemon. The 2008 financial crisis would be the second. Each of these weakening in the United States, the center-left internationalists and the center-right internationalists. So you do see these problems that have to do with performance and conflicting and entangling what kind of international order do you want to live in with the role of a great power, the United States, which paradoxically you need to be there putting his shoulder to the wheel to keep the order open. You have to have powerful states who will provide power and promote stakeholders who can be part of that preservation and upholding of the order, but they also are great powers with their own objectives. And so they worry about hegemonic rivals. They worry about regional security that have nothing to do with liberal order, but it conflates and conflicts with the functioning of the order. And so the U.S. is seen as both indispensable for that order and truly ruinous in many ways at the same time. And there's the paradox.
A question for you. Have you filled out the ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary. And if you're lucky, you might win 250 pounds in vouchers.
So we often talk about the 1990s in the context of other larger resets in history like 1815, 1919, and 1945. Is that a fair way to conceptualize this period, or are there other issues in doing so?
I think it is a good way of framing the first go at the analysis because it is a moment that looks a lot like one of these post-war moments, 1648, 1713, 1815, 1919, 1945. But it's different. It's not a hot war. It's not a war where the old order was broken down. In fact, it was a kind of a conservative revolution in the sense that one half of the order collapsed and the other half remained standing. So the bipolar system where the liberal order was inside of one of the two halves, the inside order by the terms of the collapse of the Cold War order became the outside order. So the inside order became the outside order. And that is where the problems begin, the expansion of this order in ways that are not, as we were saying earlier, built into the bargained institutions of that order, willy-nilly kind of expanding outward, countries joining, but not necessarily in a kind of coherent, comprehensive package that you associate with fully functioning political orders that have boundaries, that have expectations, that have terms for participation. So it is a kind of a period where you can ask many of the same questions that you ask at these other moments. The U.S. and its allies were now in a position to really speak globally about how the order might be organized. And so it was a moment like these others to raise the questions that often are put in the background because emergencies and exigencies always crowd out long-term visions of the future. But these are moments where you have a breakpoint where you actually have an incentive as a major power like the United States to think about 10, 20, 30 years from now, because what you do today will have consequences for those 20, 30 year out years. And so that kind of temporality, momentary advantages for locking in today, things that will advantage you tomorrow, is similar to these other moments. And therefore, it's useful to put it in the company of these other post-war moments.
I would agree that just basically it's useful to situate that moment or to use the 1990s to juxtapose it, put it in a comparative historical context, and look at other periods that are considered to be breakpoints, if only to identify the ways in which it was not. And I think one of the takeaways in the book, and this really comes out very clearly in Dan Dresner's piece in the book, is that it wasn't a breakpoint in the kind of classic sense. It was not transformative. It was more a period of consolidation where the side that was left standing was able to consolidate its gains. The way that it consolidated its gains, though, was that it expanded or it pushed the boundaries of many of these policies beyond which others outside, those on the outside that were being brought in, were prepared to fully acknowledge or accept or abide by, and that those on the inside found destabilizing, that they were eroding the benefits that they got when it was a club as opposed to a kind of global order. So I think just as an analytic exercise, it's useful to try to do these kind of comparisons and draw out the contrasts.
Thank you. So how much of the current decline of the liberal international order can trace its roots in the decisions made by leaders in the 1990s?
In a way, we've covered a lot of this already, so let me focus on what I think leaders didn't understand at the time, and that, in my judgment, has contributed to the decline of the erosion and the fracture of the liberal order. In an interview near the end of his life, and he lived a long life, George Kennan, the father of America's Cold War strategy of containment, was asked why the United States ultimately prevailed in its decades-long struggle with the Soviet Union. So Kennan said, well, the answer is that as long as the Soviet Union was an alternative, there was always something worse in the world than American hegemony. With the end of the Cold War, America's great comparative advantage disappeared. And while its immense power advantages, its preponderant power, it had such advantages it could confidently assume that other states would not balance against it, at least in the short run, in the near term, middle term. That did not mean that they would not take exception to how that power was wielded and for what purposes. And so John was referring to the Iraq War, that was Exhibit A. And today, we're seeing the same thing unfold, where America's oldest allies are telling the Trump administration that we can't support your war in Iran. The United States is out there, in many respects, for much of this period, without that counterpoint that the Soviet Union, two clashing versions of modernity, going at it. And so in the U.S. one, was more appealing to many when they compared it to the alternative.
I might also just mention George Kennan. I was thinking, in answering your question, what Kennan writes at the very end of his long telegram, the actual first text for the containment doctrine that he sent from Moscow back to Washington. And in it, he basically said the struggle with the Soviet Union ultimately had less to do with contending military power and more to do with whether the West, and he meant both the United States and its allies, could remain a viable and successful project in organizing politics, economics, and society. Can it be a successful polity that advances the human condition? And if its approach works, it will succeed in the long term because the Soviet approach will pale in comparison. And so in many ways, I think the 1990s started out successfully on a good note, trying to come back to what is it that makes liberal democracy, the Western project, and all the kind of assemblage of particular projects and aspirations work. And so in some ways, I think we can see successes that were achieved there that we shouldn't dismiss in our gloominess today, that not all went wrong there. In fact, it was more of a success than it could have otherwise have been if these collaborations, these alliances, these partnerships had all collapsed, as many people thought they would. The glue of democratic solidarity was greater than a lot of people, most people thought. And I was at the State Department in 1991 when the collapse of the Soviet Union really was ratified, and people worried, what's the glue that's going to hold this world together? And the glue was shared values and interests of these countries, the glue factory of world order, a democracy. But I think that what is different today, and this is how I would answer the question somewhat indirectly, the 1990s really did seem like a period where liberal democracy was on the move, and probably too optimistic, as we've been talking today about the expansionary possibilities. Countries could join and transition and find a place. It hasn't totally worked out that way. And indeed, in the West itself, as we've also said, there are critics and reactionary movements, call it alt-America, alt-liberalism, that is seeking to take the U.S. back to an earlier period. And it's really at that moment today where there is a kind of recession of liberal democracy that we might want to look back to an earlier period, not the 1990s, but the 1940s and 50s. When the prospects for democracy were not altogether that bright. The late 30s with World War II, a kind of extinction moment was possible. What, six or seven democracies survived at that point? It was really hanging by a thread. And yet these countries found a way to circle the wagons and work on the basics and develop what we might call a trade security grouping, ratified in various regional institutions, and the U.S. embraced it as well. And so there is a lot we can look back on for inspiration as we navigate today's very difficult period.
And then sort of following on from that, as the U.S. reaches its 250th anniversary this year, what lessons can its leaders take from the decisions made in the 1990s that are still affecting global politics now?
Well, there are many. And I should say, John and I are working on an article slowly about the lessons from the period. But for me, the most important and enduring is something former Secretary of State Dean Acheson once said in a speech that he gave before the American Society of Newspaper Editors in April 1950. He told them, in quotes, "There is no longer any difference between foreign questions and domestic questions. They're all part of the same question." And what he understood, what Acheson understood, is that the international order and domestic stability were inseparable. Each was required to guarantee the success of the other. And in the years and the decades that followed, the imperatives of geopolitics and social democracy / the welfare state reinforced and buttressed this view in one Western democracy after another. Basically, political leaders had to guarantee, to use FDR's language, guarantee their citizens freedom from want as well as freedom from fear, if they hoped to sustain popular support for international openness and cooperation and to blunt the appeal of illiberalism. And this Janus face, it's a double-faced approach to statecraft, has been lost as foreign and domestic policy have become disconnected, each operating in isolation, increasingly at cross purposes with each other. And in my view, this is what needs to be addressed if we hope to pull ourselves out of the morass that we're in.
So I would answer the question by saying that the 1990s should be remembered as a bit of an anomaly, that across 250 years, the 90s really stand out as a decade unlike any other that the United States experienced. It was a decade when it looked like everything was going its way and all the principles, whether openness, rule of law, democracy, shared values, and growth through trade, all of this seemed to be making the world a better place, and the United States was right at the center of it. But over 250 years, it's been a much more hit and miss, up and down, two steps forward, one step back, agonistic kind of struggle. The democracies, liberal democracies, and the United States' role as a leading liberal democracy has had as many reversals and backsteps and struggles with other great powers that we should remember that. We should not necessarily hold today's agenda to the standard of the 1990s, but remember the longer period. And so what I would suggest be the message to our current leaders, drawing on 250 years of liberal internationalism and American foreign policy, would be hold your democratic allies and partners close, build trade and security ties that create strength in numbers, and make the case to the worried and insecure citizens of liberal democracies that the ideals upon which their societies are founded are worth defending. Those just happen to be the last sentences that I've written today, so there you have it.
Well, that sounds like a great place for us to finish. Before we do finish, I'd just like to give you both the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any recent or upcoming books, articles, or other projects you're working on that you think they might find to be of interest.
Well, I'm working on a big book with a co-author, longtime co-author, Dan Dooney from Johns Hopkins University, which is looking at 250 years of American world impact across many, many eras and decades, and the way in which the U.S. as a new type of political project, Republican constitutional order, a new order of the ages, had a kind of revolutionary set of principles that have radiated outward in different ways in terms of North America, the hemisphere, the Atlantic, and the larger global system. So a kind of reflection on the bigger picture, the long durée, to try to put today's problems in perspective by breaking out of the news cycle and looking across not just decades, but centuries for insights on the ups and downs and hopefully the continuing arc of upward movement in human aspirations defined by Enlightenment values, perhaps. So that's what I'm up to.
So I'm also working on a book. It's a book that's been set aside multiple times to do other books like this one that we've just been talking about. It's a project, a book about America's international trajectory from Monroe to Trump, and how and when new geopolitical ideas triumph and reset America's strategic compass, as I call it. And the core argument is that the United States right now is going through one of its periodic realignments in geopolitical thought and action that began before Trump, but that has accelerated on Trump's watch, that will only be resolved when the strategy meets two critical conditions, that it aligns with geopolitical realities on the ground, and it allows those holding the reins of power to build a winning coalition at home. So I'm planning on using case studies from America's past to show the leaders used that, did that. When they got it right, they were satisfying both of those conditions. And when they got it wrong, like an example would be Wilson, it's because they only had one half of it. So I'm hoping to create some space and some time to be able to see this book through. It's kind of been on the back burner, but very much on my mind.
Well, our listeners should definitely look out for those volumes in due course. And all the other resources we've talked about today will be in our show notes. Just remains for me to say, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark.
Great to be with you, Chris. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris. Glad to be here.
G. John Eikenberry is the Albert G. Milbank Professor of Politics and International Affairs at Princeton University in the Department of Politics and the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. Peter Trubowitz is Professor of International Relations and Director of the Phelan U.S. Center at LSE and Associate Fellow at Chatham House Royal Institute of International Affairs. Rethinking the 1990s, Liberal World Order Building in the Aftermath of the Cold War is available from Oxford University Press. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor G. John Eikenberry and Professor Peter Trubowitz for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Evan Fassa. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Arrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and like lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at LSE_US and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. Helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast don't reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.
Play ball!